We are calling this House Fisheries meeting to order at 8:35 on Wednesday. And the only subject we have on our calendar today is the confirmation hearing for Denby Lloyd for Commissioner of Department of Fish and Game. And first of all, I wanted to draw everybody's attention to letters that we have on the desk. And I'll recognize that at this time we have with us Representative Johnson, Representative Ledoux, Representative Johansson, Representative Edgman, myself, Chair Seaton. And we have on our desk letters from Cordova Fishermen, Cordova District Fishermen United, and support letter from Southeast Alaska Fishermen's Alliance, support letter from Alaska Draggers Association, a support letter from Mr. Bob Wallace, a support letter from Mr. John Murray, and a support letter from Mr. Bob Thornton Jr. So those are the communications that we have for this confirmation hearing. The procedures, of course, in this hearing is we are looking at the qualifications and assessing the qualifications of the nominee to be forwarded to a joint session of the House and Senate. This goes forward to that body, and if anyone, so we won't have a vote on that issue, but if someone wants to put a comment of support or opposition, they can do it on the transmittal letter to the joint session that we'll have to look at confirmation hearings. There will be a public hearing. We'll have that at the end. We'll ask people to keep their comments short and informative in things that might help the committee assess the qualifications of the nominee for the position. And, you know, of course, those aren't kind of personal problems that anybody's had. This is assessing the qualifications for filling the duties of the deputy commissioner. So what we'll do is we'll go through the presentation by Commissioner Lloyd first, and then we will have committee discussion and questions. And what I want to do is first put everybody on notice that what I want to do is have bear, wolf, trapping, sport and subsistence hunting, rifle ranges, and all those kind of issues should be held for the Resources Committee, because they will have a hearing on this nominee as well. So we'll just be concentrating on the fisheries issues here. And, you know, I want to segregate this so that we're not jumping around all over the place for the commissioner to answer questions. So the first thing that we'd like to do after his presentation is talk about general and managerial questions, and then go into federal and international, you know, Pacific Salmon Treaty, International Pacific Halibut Commission, North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, or any other international kind of issues. Then go into subsistence, following that with a section on sport and personal use fisheries, followed with commercial fisheries, mariculture, and then any additional items that anybody wants to bring up. So if we'll go through those and we'll bring those up as sections. And so if you have questions within any of those sections, let's ask them at that time if we can. Commissioner Lloyd, would you like to come up? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, before we start, I would like to, and we talked about this earlier, but I do need to leave for a budget closeout, and we'll be scooting out, and it's no disrespect to you. It's just we have to have the votes to get your budget out, I think.
I appreciate that.
It happens to be your budget.
And I'd like to recognize that there are several members of our committee that are on the Fish and Game Budget Finance Subcommittee. So when those people leave, it'll be on the record so people can catch up on any other testimony, but everybody should know that people aren't leaving because they're tired of listening to you.
Although that may be the case.
It may become the case.
Good morning. Would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Denby Lloyd, and I'm the commissioner designate for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And I guess I'm not certain what kind of introductory remarks you'd like, but with your leave, I'll give you just a very quick general background of my education experience. I first came to Alaska almost 35 years ago to attend the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, where I received degrees in biological science and biological oceanography. I've held a number of positions with federal and state agencies and local government agencies throughout Alaska since that time, primarily with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, but also with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, with the Office of the Governor, with the Aleutians East Borough, and with the National Marine Fisheries Service, in addition to some research time with the University of Alaska. My experience has been with habitat issues. My first permanent job with the Department of Fish and Game was in the Habitat Division in the early 1980s. I have pretty broad experience with state-federal relations on fisheries, primarily through various jobs in the Department of Fish and Game, as well as the North Pacific Council, where I was primarily the management analyst for Bering Sea and Aleutian Islands groundfish, but also dealt with halibut management issues and things like that. I've dealt with policy issues at the governor's level in previous administrations, as well as now currently this one. And I've had to deal directly with local interests, primarily through my experience with the Aleutians East Borough, but also with some contracting arrangements with the Kodiak Island Borough and elsewhere. I guess I just want to give you a general feeling of my approach to resource management in Alaska. I'm very heartened by the words and the strength of our Constitution, which specifies a number of basic guidelines: management for sustained yield, management for maximum benefit, management for the people of Alaska. We didn't have people here, we wouldn't be managing our resources. That's a fundamental premise, I believe. Also, these are public resources, and they require management for the public trust. I think that anybody who is going to perform the job as commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game is going to need to represent a broad array of interests, but while dealing with that broad array of interests, is going to have to keep a focus on primarily protecting and developing the resources of the state, and not to get involved in any particular user group's priority or preference other than the state of preference for subsistence. So I know that my background has primarily been in commercial fisheries, but my view is that, and my experience, maybe I'll digress a little bit, even within commercial fisheries, there are a number of user group allocation disputes, and I'm well used to those, and I'm also well used to taking a neutral stance to the extent that that's required under state law. But under our relationships through the federal government, there are some instances where this position also does represent the state of Alaska as an advocate. So there's a variety of roles played here, but a sense of fair play and dealing with good, solid scientific information and upfront policy analysis, I believe, is required to well represent the department in the state of Alaska. And I can apply that viewpoint to sport fish interests, wildlife conservation interests, as well as commercial fishery interests that I focused on in the past. So with that, I guess I'd open up to any questions unless you'd like me to pursue any particular line of inquiry.
Okay, well, let's while we're on this kind of general and managerial section, would you go into the relationship that you see the commissioner's office having with the Board of Fish and your duties for managing for sustained yield and managing for the maximum use and your emergency order authority versus the Board of Fish regulatory policy setting authority and how that those two dueling duties get fulfilled, and how we don't leave fisheries fish on the table. Is that close enough to
well, I think I can
know
pursue
where I'm
that.
Going, or do you
well,
want to more?
Well, I believe so, and if I don't cover the bases, I'm sure you'll ask me a follow-up question. I don't necessarily see them as dueling responsibilities. I believe actually, and for the most part, they're very complementary, and I think we're fortunate to have the system. The department is charged with providing the scientific and other background information upon which the board makes a number of policy and regulatory decisions. And then subsequent to those decisions, it's the department's job again to implement those management plans that are derived from the board's deliberations. So the department's role is prior to board consideration and after the board's deliberation. But fortunately, the department is largely outside of the arena of making those hard allocation decisions amongst various user groups. Now, there are some instances where, as you mentioned, the department is charged with making emergency order decisions in season, and I think that's actually a strength of Alaska's management system, that we can make decisions at a very local level based on ever-changing conditions in real time. For the most part, that works very, very well. The Board of Fish lays out management plans that set overall guidelines for performance. The department, based on scientific information, and now I'm speaking specifically salmon, lays out escapement goals. And in season, then, the department uses EO authority fairly routinely to open and close various fisheries so that, ideally anyway, the escapements into the various systems come in within the escapement goal ranges, and all available harvestable surplus is captured by the various fisheries. I think the only difficulty comes in, and maybe this is what you're alluding to, is when there aren't clear goals specified for what it is the commissioner and delegated agents within the department are utilizing their emergency order authority for. And if there are conflicting goals, then there's some judgment involved in how best to manage in season, and sometimes various user groups will think that different forms of judgment ought to be applied, and that's where we sometimes get into difficulty.
Thank you, and I guess I want to just follow up a little bit on that, because it's been, as you know, in fisheries a real contentious issue as to whether the specificity of some of the management plans are getting to the point of taking away the authority for in-season management. And specifically, you know, we could relate this as an example to Upper Cook Inlet, because that's probably the one that everybody, we get the most concern about.
Mm-hmm.
And the such as window closures that have a date specific, not a run timing specific. How do you, as commissioner, if we have run timing that is early or late versus a policy that was set by dates and times, how do you balance that to get the maximum harvest? Or will you use your emergency order authority to have those kind of openings, or are you going to be more along the line of, well, the board has set some timelines here, and that's where it's at?
Well, you mentioned the Upper Cook Inlet management plans in particular, and I think that's probably the one area in the state where we have the most apparent conflict or confusion amongst conflicting goals in the management plan. And just for ease of conversation, I'll describe them in two veins. One is, typically in commercial salmon fisheries, we very clearly have a direct mandate to manage the harvest so that we get escapements within the range of an escapement goal that's specified, understood, everybody knows what it is. And we use emergency order authority to get the fisheries and the appropriate harvest pressure to our best of our ability to attain those escapement goals. However, in Upper Cook Inlet, we also have conflicting direct management objectives in the Board of Fish Management plans that specify certain closed windows during certain portions of the summer. And that creates a conflict. Just with those two pieces of information, the department doesn't have clear guidance on what to use its emergency order authority for. If, for example, more harvest pressure is required to keep the escapements below the upper range of an escapement goal. Now, I think the department would clearly use its emergency order authority to increase harvest in the case of a very large run that was going to exceed the upper end of the escapement goal if it was clear that that would somehow damage the run. However, the scientific information that would lead to that conclusion is right now equivocal. So again, there's not a clear signal to the department on what to do in the case of large runs potentially exceeding an escapement goal with a countervailing directive of the board to have closed windows. So in my mind, that leaves, again, an unfortunate level of judgment required in the commissioner's office that's largely an allocation issue. And we would ideally prefer the Board of Fisheries to address that question and state a preference, what would be the overarching goal.
So am I hearing you say that the sustainability requirement, you have to have proof that it's going to damage the run, even though you know it's above the damaged future runs, even though it's above the escapement goal within your which you're going to manage, before you would exercise your emergency order authority?
That would be an extreme situation, but yeah, that's what I would be looking for a clean decision, in order to absolutely keep fishing pressure going in, let's see, what people call outside of the current management plans. In other words, to violate the directive to also have closed windows. Because there's a user group that relies on those closed window periods to get a density of fish into the river systems for sport fishing harvest opportunity. And that's a directive of the Board of Fisheries as well. It's one of their potential allocation directives and decisions that they get to make between competing users. And unless the department has clear reason to override that judgment, I'm a bit at a loss on how to make that decision between two competing user groups when the department typically doesn't enter into those allocation decisions.
So then to follow up, your philosophy for the commissioner would be that he's not going to exercise that emergency order authority to achieve the maximum benefit to the people, but just to make sure that we don't have a long-term situation where we have damaged the sustainability?
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, I wouldn't phrase it like that, because what I'm trying to keep the department from doing is arbitrating what maximum benefit to the people means in this case. The Board of Fisheries is making public policy decisions. One aspect of the benefit is certainly achieving as much of the harvestable surplus for commercial harvest as possible. And typically, everywhere else in the state, that's a clear message, a clear directive to the department. But in this case, there's also a directive from the board. They're looking for benefits to accrue to the sport fishery as well. And I don't want the department to be in the job of arbitrating between maximum benefit for commercial users, maximum benefit to sport users, and what that equates to maximum benefit to the people of Alaska. I believe that's more appropriately the job of the Board of Fisheries.
Okay, and since I guess you're under the management plan, you can have the ability to increase the sport harvest from 3 to 6,
mm-hmm.
but that's your maximum that you can do. And if you're having more fish than can be harvested, I mean, you're having excess fish even beyond after a 6-fish limit is in, have we then gotten to that point of exceeding, or is it still back to the Board of Fish? I mean, if you've used all your tools to take some of those excess fish above the upper escapement goal, do we now have a situation in which we're saying, okay, we are going to overescape, we have no tool for taking any of those fish, and so we know that there are going to be fish that are going to be left in the river, because it doesn't matter. You're constrained at 6 fish by the management plan for sport use. Does there become a point there at which you have to decide that you've done everything you can to maximize the use of those fish, or are we talking about different stocks of fish at this point? I was talking about the kenai.
Yeah, I was following you there until you said other stocks of fish at this point. I've been participant in some of these discussions in season for the last couple of years, and we constantly get advice from the Department of Law of what, you know, the kind of the limits of our in-season authority is, and there might be some reasonable debate about whether we've exercised that correctly in past years, but we would be looking for all available opportunities to capture that harvestable surplus within the management plans. It's when we have to go outside of the stated management plans of the Board of Fisheries that things get a little dicey in terms of judgment and how to apply that judgment against the law and against the expectations of the users that we won't be preferring one or the other unduly, I guess. And that's always a dilemma. In Cook Inlet, it's more so of a dilemma given the intensity of use there. We are going to be participating with the board in exactly a discussion of exactly this issue on the conflicts inherent in the way the current management plans are structured. And I'm hoping we can derive some guidance or wisdom from those discussions. But I'm being fairly candid with you, Mr. Chair, that right now, as I see it anyway, there's a fundamental conflict between the two mandates within the overarching Cook Inlet management plan that put us in a conundrum. And I wish I had, you know, an answer that would satisfy everybody, and I don't believe I do right now.
And that's probably the what I was looking for is to, you know, you are trying to get a solution to those conflicts.
Because yes.
Of course, we've seen, and we'll talk about, you know, escapement stuff later, but, you know, we want to see the best managed fisheries and the flexibility for you and your staff to manage the fisheries in the way to achieve the best return for everyone in the state, both sport and commercial. And so hopefully the board will agree with you on some more flexibility as well. So
appreciate that.
Anyone have any other questions on general topics or managerial questions? Representative Ledoux.
What's your vision or your department's vision as to a rationalization plan for ground fish?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ledoux,
just so you know, we've segued into the next phase here from the general to the federal and international. So there.
Just for some background, the rationalization effort is largely in the federal arena through the North Pacific Management Council. And as you're aware, the governor had requested that the council stand down from proceeding with Gulf of Alaska groundfish rationalization for a time period actually leading up to next October, at least, I think was the date requested, so that the administration could prepare position or a vision on what the administration would like to see rationalization look like.
Can I stop you for a minute for the committee and the people watching in? Could you go ahead and define what the state sees rationalization to be and what that term means?
Well, that's interesting. I don't like the use of the word rationalization for this, but I don't get to coin the terms of art. So I think to many people, rationalization of fisheries means some form of limitation and control on the number of people that participate. So arguably, even our salmon license limitation program is a form of rationalization. However, I think it's also come to mean in some people's minds something beyond just license limitation and more towards a share program such as individual fishing quotas, IFQs, where people are granted the privilege to a certain share of the harvestable surplus and they can utilize that as they see fit. Certainly IFQ programs are very controversial, partly because they do limit participation, and partly because in the past, at least, those rights have been gifted or simply granted to existing participants based on their history of participation in the fishery, and from there forward are sold from one person to another. And I know that there's some concern with this by this administration with that particular aspect of rationalization. And that aspect is what people are calling privatization, basically taking the rights to a public resource and giving them away to private individuals. And the effect of that is to take the future stream of benefits from that public resource and vest them into private hands. And there are some objections to that. And in fact, I believe this administration will be objecting to that procedure. There are ways, however, to achieve the benefits of rationalization, which are, in some cases, longer seasons, more flexibility for individual operators to harvest when and where they choose, under what conditions they choose, and thus reduce their costs. Some of those benefits can be achieved without privatizing the resource. And I think, shy of any more details, because we haven't had full discussions yet within the administration, shy of further development of those, we are proceeding with an eye towards looking at the possibility of deriving those benefits without privatizing resources.
Representative Ledoux.
Would this be appropriate time to take a short break? Because I've got to get to that meeting also for the fisheries closeout, and that just leaves.
We got lots of questions.
Yeah, we got lots of questions.
We can go on.
Yeah. We'll, I'll tell you what, since I know you're very interested in rationalization, what we'll do is we'll go off of this topic and then pick it up when you get back, as soon as you get through with the vote. So.
Thanks.
Question.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Mr. Lloyd, first of all, I appreciate you, your public service. I know you could probably be somewhere else making a lot more money, having a lot more fun. So we appreciate you taking on this task.
Thank you.
Pacific Salmon Treaty, being from District 1, very important to us down there, and we're renegotiating, I believe, coming up pretty quick here.
Yes.
Can you just summarize the team that you have going and your sort of thoughts about that process?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, the Pacific Salmon Treaty is basically up for renegotiation now. The current annexes, as I understand it, expire at the end of 2008, so we need to have renegotiated positions in place by the beginning of 2009. So we have a little less than 2 years to accommodate this. The negotiating sessions have already begun. As you're probably aware, this treaty between Canada and the U.S. doesn't just pit U.S. interests against Canadian ones in some regards, but also U.S. against U.S., where Alaskan interests aren't necessarily those of Washington and Oregon for access to harvestable surpluses of Chinook, sockeye, and coho for the most part. The team we have in place is largely the team that has, I think, very successfully represented us in the past in ongoing implementation of the previous annexes, and that is David Bedford will remain as deputy commissioner of the department, and his focus is very largely oriented towards the Pacific Salmon Treaty and the Pacific Salmon Commission process. And we also have Gordy Williams, who is very experienced in this program. We have a number of technical assistants that are either full-time or part-time and contract employees with the department. And I don't know if you're familiar with some of these folks, but Dave Gaudette, John Clark, and a number of others are deeply involved in this process. We have an excellent technical team, both in the commissioner's office and in the southeast region of both the divisions of commercial fisheries and sport fisheries. Some of the issues that it appears we're going to have to buffer ourselves against is not only, I think, some of the concerns of Washington, Oregon, and harvest sharing agreements with Canada, but what appears to be a push by our own federal administration to deal with salmon recovery in the Pacific Northwest through harvest reductions, rather than more directly through habitat mitigation and amelioration of effects of the dam programs and others, other things in Washington, Oregon. We need to be particularly vigilant in providing the science that defends our harvest regimes up here, as well as remains familiar with the harvest regimes in lower 48 in Canada, and we are prepared to do that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I know it's extremely complicated, and that history and experience by these people is very important, so I appreciate you keeping those folks on. It's really important to our fishermen in the southeast. Thank you.
One federal issue or international issue. Taken care of. How about let's go on to the International Pacific Halibut Commission?
Do we have to?
I know. Well, it's first of all, I guess, since you would be as a designated member on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which is had a proposal from the IPHC. My understanding is the Secretary of Commerce and Secretary of State rejected that proposal, and so it's back in the council's lap. Can you tell us where your philosophy or the state's philosophy will be as far as looking at that halibut issue in charter halibut? And let me just lay out a couple more things while we're going, and whether you want to address some of the ZAD or the state application about the captain and crews fishing on during the commercial operations of a charter vessel, and how that is allowed or not allowed under either NPFMC or under this state, and what the philosophy is there. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this is a fairly complex issue because it is driven by yet another treaty, an international treaty between the U.S. and Canada. And halibut have been managed for over 100 years by the International Pacific Halibut Commission. More recently, through the Northern Pacific Halibut Act, the allocation decisions within the U.S. have been delegated to the respective councils. So for Alaska, those allocation decisions have been delegated to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and for Washington and Oregon to the Pacific Management Council. So generally, it's become to be understood that the IPHC, the Halibut Commission, deals with the overarching biological decisions each year and sets the allowable harvest levels, and then leaves the allocation of those to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and the federal government through the National Marine Fisheries Service. The commercial take is, as you know, managed under a individual fishing quota system, the IFQ program, but the sport harvest is basically controlled simply by a long-standing two-fish bag limit, two fish per day. There has been a growing halibut charter sector that, as far back as the mid-90s, was increasing their catch to the point that the commercial fishing interest became concerned that that escalating harvest would in the future cut into the allowable take by commercial interest. And so they brought the issue to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and asked for a regulatory program that would put a cap on halibut charter take. And deriving from that request, then there was discussion about how the halibut charter industry would be regulated in and of itself. That's kind of the long-winded background to where we found ourselves this year, which was the projection that, well, last year the halibut charter sector exceeded what the North Pacific Council had previously laid out as their target guideline harvest level, the GHL. And various commercial interests went to the International Pacific Halibut Commission this year, saying that the council, the North Pacific Council, had not yet constrained the charter harvest to within the guideline. Therefore, they wanted the Halibut Commission, which is an international body, to put a limit on that halibut charter harvest. The Halibut Commission actually chose to take that action and reduced the daily bag limit for Area 2C, which is southeast Alaska, and for Area 3A, which is basically south central Alaska, from two fish to one fish for a certain period of time during the summer, 6 weeks for southeast and a two-week period in south central. The Department of Fish and Game sent a letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service, to Dr. Jim Balsiger, who also happens to be a halibut commissioner, and expressed concern with that decision. At the first level, because we didn't believe that the international body should be making those types of allocation, domestic allocation decisions, that we believe the North Pacific Council should be. However, we also recognize that the council hadn't taken action sufficient to constrain that harvest. So we had asked National Marine Fisheries Service to review the decision of the Halibut Commission and look for alternatives administratively for something other than a draconian one fish bag limit to achieve the harvest reductions in the charter sector while still then providing opportunity for the North Pacific Council to deal with this issue internally. Recently, as you know, the Federal Secretary of State and Secretary of Commerce have indeed denied the IPHC regulation to reduce the bag limit, and National Marine Fisheries Service is engaged right now in developing an alternative for southeast Alaska to achieve the same level of harvest reduction in the charter sector. What NMFS has also recognized, however, is that the Department of Fish and Game's efforts by emergency order to prohibit retention of halibut by skipper and crew of charter vessels, that would achieve the necessary harvest reduction in Area 3A in south central Alaska. So no further action, at least for this year, is required by the National Marine Fisheries Service. So for south central, the bag limit will remain at a two fish bag limit as it has been for years. And for this year, no other restriction other than the state's emergency order will be required. So we are focused on, for 2007, an effort to find an alternative to a one-fish bag limit that would still provide some harvest reduction. That's the near term. Of course, the long-term solution still remains with the North Pacific Council to figure out how best to constrain the charter sector's harvest. We are engaged right now in the final action coming up soon on a moratorium for new entrants to the charter fishery to be imposed by the council. And subsequently thereafter, the moratorium would have to lead to something, and there's a longer-term discussion with the stakeholders group as well as with the council on what that longer-term solution would be. One idea is, again, individual fishing quotas or some limit to angler days that would be a proxy for IFQ and or a license limitation scheme. And those are the three kind of main options on the table, although there's pretty wide-ranging discussion going on in the council arena.
Okay, thank you. And so the skipper and crew is restriction is an emergency order by the state?
That's correct.
And is that in both areas?
Yes.
Okay, but
and Mr. Chairman,
I should, is the goal for South Central, but it doesn't get to the level that you were identifying for Southeast.
That's correct.
Okay. And has there been any question or problem about the applicability of the state regulation of charter vessels with their fishing for halibut?
Mr. Chairman, there is a complication that because halibut is managed by international treaty and then through federal government, the state doesn't have direct authority to manage halibut. So our emergency order restricting skipper and crew on charter vessels from retaining fish is applying to, I believe, all sport fish. We can't single it out to just halibut. In a related effort, we have gone to our congressional delegation and requested statutory language that would allow the North Pacific Council to delegate certain management authority for halibut through the council to the state of Alaska, but we have not yet been successful.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions on the halibut issue?
Chairman?
Yes, Representative Johans.
I think I may have misunderstood you, but was the decision to ban the skippers and crew based on halibut or just a general policy?
Mr. Chairman, the decision was based on a need to reduce the harvest of halibut.
Okay.
But we had also heard through this arena as well as others that there was concern about retention of fish or fishing by skipper and crew when they had clients on board. So we viewed this as a relatively acceptable mechanism, even though it applied to other species than just halibut.
Thank you.
And to be consistent here in our thoughts, is there currently a restriction on commercial fishing vessel that has any commercial fish on board from participating in any sport fishery?
I believe that's the case, but don't quote me directly on that, but I do believe that's the case.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that everybody understood that that restriction is also applied to commercial fishing vessels when they're, if they have any commercial fish on board. And you got back just in time. We've got through halibut, which you didn't want to hear anyway.
No, not necessarily.
At the Pacific salmon
pretty
treaty.
Important to Kodiak too.
That's right. And now we're back to the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. And are you ready for your question or your follow-up question, or you want to wait a minute?
I'll just wait a minute.
Okay. Commissioner, with the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, one of the big questions has been the federal philosophy of allocating fishing privileges and fishing rights to investors versus the state philosophy of allocating any rights or privileges to participants. And you have to be a participating fisherman. You have to be out there at the operation of the gear. Seems to be a very direct philosophical difference between the allocation schemes that are, every one of them, doesn't matter whether it's IFQ or anything else, LLPs, those all go to the person that has the investment, whether they're fishing or not, or what, vessel owner. What is going to be your philosophy in the council process, especially where it relates to fisheries that go across the state and federal line, where we have the state philosophy that says you have to be a participant and you have to be on board, and the federal philosophy that has generally said it goes to the investor and they don't have to be on board?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know that I have a quick sound bite in that regard, but I think we need to recognize the investors, but we also do need to recognize the participants. And I agree that thus far, for the most part, the council arena has recognized the investors much more so than the participants. However, in the halibut program, they made some efforts at least to require that eligible participants be those that have some background operating vessels and being at sea. It's arguable whether that's sufficient, and there are also some leasing provisions for folks who were initially issued quota that I think we need to review. I believe this administration is going to take a hard look at any future rationalization program and or the review of existing ones towards benefiting not just, say, skipper or skipper and crew, but also communities. The soundbite, if there is one for this administration, I believe, is that we will be looking for aggregate benefits to communities rather than individual harvesting groups or individual processing groups.
Okay, and I appreciate that, because the processing, those tying those things together and has been, as you know, quite difficult or quite contentious. But I would hope that the state has the ability to nominate and have selected six of the 11 voting commissioners or council members. And, the state's philosophy, I hope, would prevail in any fisheries that are taking fish in state waters, because otherwise we're going to get into a large legal, constitutional, and all those kinds of aspects. And I know that in the past, people have been there so long that they have kind of migrated over to the federal philosophy and the state instead of the state's philosophy. So I would hope you will be able to make sure that the philosophy you're talking about here goes throughout the employment base. Representative Ledoux.
Well, I noticed that the council is going to be meeting again at its next meeting to review, I think, the crab rationalization program. Do you or the administration have any suggestions as to how that program should be changed, or do you think it should be changed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ledoux, we don't have specific recommendations for change right now. And at the April council meeting coming up, we will be receiving a discussion paper from the council staff on what's called the 18-month review of the crab rationalization program. That review is supposed to be focused on a number of elements, specifically the what's called the 90-10 split of the harvester shares and their ties to processors that hold processor quota, and also the binding arbitration scheme between harvesters and processors. We will be looking at that discussion paper in April, and probably by June, begin to articulate what, if any, changes to the system ought to be promoted in order to deal with the problems identified in that discussion paper. I don't have a list of solutions yet because we haven't had the full suite of the problems articulated yet, but we will be paying close attention to that.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions on federal or international issues? Let's go on there to well, now let me back up a little more on council stuff. One of the things that we've seen is the bycatch and waste problem in the fisheries. And do you support mandating changes of gear if that accomplishes reduction of wastage and bycatch, or is it just we allocate the primary species and let everything else fall where it may?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of an either-or question, and I'll come down somewhere in the middle. Certainly, we all have a goal in reducing bycatch to the extent that that bycatch is unutilized. However, simply deciding that forcing people to shift gear types is the answer, I think, is too simplistic a solution. That doesn't mean we ought not to be looking at that possibility, but we also need to consider what certain gear types are most useful for in harvesting certain resources. So I guess my answer to you would be I'm happy to look at those possibilities and try to achieve the overall goal of bycatch reduction. But I'm going to stop short of saying that we want to be mandating gear shifts to accomplish that.
Okay, and I guess I'd just like to point out the state water Pacific cod fishery that switched from trawl on long line to pot gear and saved about 2.5 million pounds of wasted halibut per year, mm-hmm. just as an example. But we have, that was in 1993, I think we did that, and we haven't seen any further shift, even though there's full ability to catch the fish with gear that doesn't have that, institute that wastage into a high value fishery, and yet there hasn't been any further move to either increase those or make the other gear less costly as far as in the wastage. So I'd hope you do look at all of those things.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thanks for bringing that up. Actually, I participated rather heavily in creating that state waters cod fishery in the mid to late 90s when I was working with the Aleutians East Borough. And very specifically, the gear types were limited to those that had de minimis bycatch. And we had the opportunity to do that. It made it much easier for the Board of Fisheries to create those fishery opportunities. And it did set a standard. I would certainly be looking for those opportunities. I guess what I was saying is I want to stop short of mandating that. For example, there are other fisheries that those types of gear types wouldn't necessarily work well for, pollock fishery and some others, for example, or arrowtooth flounder.
Oh, sure, and I was only meaning where they were applicable. We have another situation in the in the black-eyed fishery, sablefish fishery, where in some areas we're having 50 to 70% loss of the catch to whales. And my understanding is, at this point in time, even though that is a quota fishery and we have the ability to monitor where the vessels are and knowing what the bycatch rates are, we're not subtracting those losses from the quotas. And we have pot fisheries, longline pot fisheries, which were extremely effective and were replaced back a number of years ago because of competition. Would you look at either assigning the loss bycatch as a reduction to the quotas, or would you support that, or switching gears so that people have a alternative? They could either switch from longline gear in high whale areas to pots, or they could just take the bycatch reduction from their quota, that kind of an issue?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to entertain that kind of discussion. I think that that's a very worthwhile pursuit. Whether or not the reduction came right off their quota or was somehow factored into the population dynamics model, I couldn't say. But I think the investigation is well worthwhile. And I'm intrigued by the notion of having people migrate to pot gear if indeed that would produce a viable fishery for them.
Okay, and thanks. Let's go on to, if there aren't any questions on that stuff, let's go to subsistence. Does anyone have any questions on subsistence fisheries issues for the commissioner? It's a quiet topic. Okay.
Not outside this room.
Let's go to sport and personal use fisheries. Do we have questions there? Well, maybe you could address quickly the sport hatcheries that we have going and whether it appears that those are going to be effective and affordable in the what's the current assessment on those new hatcheries and the affordability of operating?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have all the facts and figures, but we are well on track with the groundwork and potential or the future construction of the hatchery in Fairbanks. We're going to be breaking ground this summer. There are some increased costs associated with that hatchery that we can cover under the current bonding structure, and for the subsequent hatchery in Anchorage, we will need to figure how best to backfill that funding picture so that we construct that hatchery as well. But we fully intend to construct both hatcheries. We believe that we have a good operational plan that will make both those hatcheries effective, and I haven't at least been told by my staff that there are any fatal flaws in the planning that we've got going for either of those.
Okay, good. Talking about personal use dip net fisheries, one of the things that I know that we see on the Kenai River is that there's no constraint on the heads and the guts being dumped out on the riverbank, and there's just windrows of heads and Is that something that you're concerned about is in the department, or does that all fall on DEC as far as waste?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're concerned about it, but it's not within our authority, at least not that I've identified yet. And so we certainly have observed the problem, both at the Kenai and the Kosilov, of the disposition of the waste, but in large measure, I believe that that's not just a DEC problem, but also a local, municipal problem. And perhaps we need to engage more fully with those authorities to help address that issue.
Okay, thank you. And I guess the only other sport fish thing I had was there's a number of efforts for rehabilitation and enhancement of clam stocks in Prince William Sound and Cook Inlet, cockles, both, and razor clams that are permitted by the department for, in fact, they're permitting private native corporations to enhance those cockles in Prince William Sound. And then there's some proposals or permits for working on enhancement of razor clams. Off Cordova, I believe. do you have any, do you support those enhancement efforts and have any problems with them?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, I don't know anything about these particular permits, so you're catching me unawares.
Okay. Any other sport fish items? Okay. Commercial fisheries. Does anyone, you have a little booklet here in front of you. And, you know, we really appreciate this. This was prepared by your department, the department, for us about and its success in achieving salmon escapement goals in monitored systems. And, you know, if we look at page one, it really shows some concern to us. I mean, if we look down there at the bottom, we have 55% of monitored streams were above their escapement goal that statewide just last year. And the big problem is, since the graph shows since 2001 through 2006, the trajectory is going the wrong way. We're having more and more. We went from 39% in 2001 being above their escapement goals to now the highest at 55% above their escapement goals. And looking at page three, it looks like, you know, Southeastern is the best area they're looking. They're finally over 51. It's 51%, over half at least, are within those escapement goals. And it's also showing good that we've, from 2001 to 2006, we've reduced the number that were below the minimum goals. That's really good. We really appreciate this presentation because it gives all of us a way of looking at the fisheries and where we're going. However, if we look on page six, which is the central region, we're again back to the statewide section, which we have 55% above their escapement goals, up from 32% in 2001. And again, that trajectory that's the wrong way. And on page nine, AYK, we went from 22% above their escapement goals in 2001 to 71% of the monitored streams above their escapement goals in 2006. And the final region on page 12, which is westward, which seems to be pretty well holding its own. However, I do note that in 2005 and 6, you know, we have managed to have less percentage below the minimum goal, which is, you know, where we want to be. But could you address this problem that we're having? I mean, we've got, it appears that there is, these are talking about the number of streams. We don't know what that economic loss is, but it appears that there could be a very large economic loss to the state. And so can you address this whole thing? And I know there's different reasons why different systems are on board. And what we want to do is find out if there's reasons that we need to give you more tools, change regulations, do something that would allow you to address some of those overescaping systems and allow that harvest. We want to provide you that tool. And so could you go ahead and just address
that? Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I want to thank you for your scrutiny on this because largely from the department's perspective, our first goal with respect to escapements is to make the minimum goal, to make sure that we get sufficient fish into the creek so that we achieve our spawning objective. And that's a long-standing base-level concern of all our area management biologists. What we've come to grips with more recently is that, indeed, there are upper bounds in some cases to the desirable biological number of fish that we would want in any of these systems. And certainly, overall, there's a foregone harvest component to getting more fish in the creek than you would otherwise want to make sure that we're achieving our spawning escapement goals. Now, The concern of upriver users aside, if I can put that aside for now in terms of allocation problems, it appears to me what you're focusing on here is what can be, in many instances, significant amounts of fish that are basically foregone harvest opportunity. And in many cases, that's indeed true. And it would behoove all of us, I think, to go back through these lists now that they've been created down to the stream level and more fully analyze what are the various causes to any one or group of those over, I hesitate to use the word overescapement because in some contexts that's used as a biological term to indicate damage. But these instances of foregone harvest, I believe, because we're going above our escapement objectives, do have many reasons. So, for example, in the Arctic Yukon-Kuskokwim, there are a number of areas where the markets have just not been there to take advantage of the harvestable surplus. In recent years, there have been fairly strong chum salmon runs, but because of transportation and logistical difficulties, the markets that had been there previously aren't there any longer. And so I don't think that that's a regulatory problem per se in terms of fishery harvest control that's limiting the take of that harvest opportunity, but simply it's a market problem. Now, perhaps we could best address that through efforts of the Department of Commerce and whether or not there are some business incentives that could be created to better capture that foregone harvest. But I don't believe in those cases that it's a fishery regulatory issue. There are some other instances, however, that it very well may be a fishery regulatory issue. Some of those are, again, conflicting objectives. So, for example, in a place like Bristol Bay, where we are trying to make sure that we attain a minimum escapement goal for the Quijac sockeye system, we have, over the past few years, allowed many millions of sockeye to enter the Branch River system. And we haven't figured out a way yet to parse that out precisely so that we can take full advantage of that harvest opportunity. We've made some steps with the Board of Fisheries to create an in-river fishery in the Branch to try to capture some of that, but we haven't been able to solve that dilemma altogether. And then there might be less precise difficulties, such as in Southeast, where, sure, we can have some openings in Chatham Strait for pink and chum salmon, but when we do our aerial surveys, we just discover that in some instances we achieved our escapement threshold, but by virtue of the fleet movements and other aspects of the fishery, more fish got up there because we didn't anticipate there'd be that many fish and or the fleet was focused elsewhere. But I'd be happy to pursue a further investigation of the specifics in this report to see if there are some particular examples, and maybe for either high volume or high value fisheries where there might be opportunities to better get at them.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, because we are, you know, this kind of comes down to our job as maximizing benefit. I appreciate that and appreciate the additional work, and hopefully the committee can work together with you. You know, we've done several things in the past to try to do some of those things, like in Southeastern, we have the direct market ability now, and we also have a transporter so that you could have more than one boat go out and not everybody have to run back to town, even if you had a lower volume fishery that you know, a cannery wouldn't send a tender for. They can combine their catches legally now for the first time if they use a transporter permit, which you guys issue free of charge. But there is some concern that the openings aren't, you know, people are looking at, well, there's fish there, but geez, there's not enough boats around there to actually do it. So do you go ahead and open it, or do you wait until, oh, well, the whole fleet's got to go there, or before we'll have an opening? I mean, there's some questions as to whether in the AYK, are they open all the time? Or is it, well, there's not enough buyers here, we're not going to have an opening. It also reduces the individual's incentive to know, okay, there's going to be fish here, we can fish. No, we can't fish because there has to be more fishermen here before they'll allow us to fish. So at some point, I hope you will look through the department and make sure that in some of these cases, it hasn't been that, well, we haven't bothered to open it, even though we had all our escapement, because we didn't have enough fishermen over there, or we didn't, you know what I'm talking about.
I see it as a chicken and egg, Mr. Chairman, problem, Mr. Chairman, yeah.
And so anyway, we would be happy to entertain changes in statute if those are necessary to give you tools to have openings or constrain, you know, whatever we need to do. I don't know what all the ideas that can be generated within the department. It'll probably take looking at those individual streams or stream systems and say, gee, how could we get some of that value back to Alaskans, and let us know if there are any. So appreciate that. Commercial fishing, anybody else? Representative Yonah.
Commissioner, dive fisheries and mariculture. When I first started working as a staffer in 1994, we started down a path to get dive fisheries going in southeast, the gooey ducks, the urchins, etc. And from then on, it seems like it's been kind of a battle, kind of a band-aid approach to getting these fisheries going. We're in front of the Finance Committee this year requesting money to just keep one of the fisheries going, etc., etc. There's legislation out there for mariculture all across the state. Do you or the department have any intention of creating a statewide plan for the expansion of these fisheries? You know, in 94 when we started, there wasn't a whole lot going on. Now it's a multi-million dollar fishery that allows other folks, as you're well aware, seiners, gill netters, trawlers, whatever, to add fisheries in the wintertime when generally their boats are not running, and of course that helps their small business. My concern is there's no real big picture management plan coming from the department. Your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johansson, you're right. We don't have a large statewide policy or a program to expand on these dive fishery and mariculture opportunities. This is, I think, an interesting opportunity for the state to invest, if they wish, into fish and wildlife management that would yield some identifiable returns. And in fact, the past efforts to have a cost assessment and cost recovery program with SARDFA, the Dive Fishery Association down here, has been one of those innovative efforts to provide base level funding for inventory and quota setting processes, so the fishermen could take advantage of what otherwise would have been an unavailable resource. Part of the difficulty, however, is that the department has a long-standing kind of core program that was derived from salmon and expanded into shellfish and now somewhat into groundfish, and without additional resources to move into dive fisheries in a large way that you're suggesting requires a fair amount of reprogramming and or new funding. And even though in the early 90s we did create a high impact and emerging fisheries policy that allowed us to get into the sea urchin fishery and the cucumber fishery early on, I think you're probably seeing that as somewhat of a band-aid, and I think in some regards we did too at the time. It was how we could focus some attention on it, but not necessarily all the attention it deserves if we're going to maximize our opportunity. There are probably a number of opportunities around the state where a little bit more investment could yield some pretty attractive identifiable returns, and we will be having those discussions within the administration, the budget process, of course, and I encourage you to think of those things as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johansson, follow up.
Yeah, I didn't see, and granted, it's a new administration, and you guys have a lot to get your arms around right now, but not being one who likes to see increments in the budget usually, I would encourage the department to work on that and come forward and request it, and get this thing going as a statewide part of Fish and Game. That's part of the normal everyday stuff, as you're talking about salmon and the other stuff. It'd be nice to have that in there as one of the things that's considered just a normal everyday operation. So I'd encourage you guys to come forward with whatever resources, the request for whatever resources you need, and start that discussion, because I think it has great potential for the entire state, not just Southeast where we're currently capitalizing, but up in the other areas across the state. Each one of us sitting here is in a coastal community, and I know there's opportunities for Representative Edgeman and Representative Ledoux and Representative Seaton's constituents to benefit. So I'd hope you guys would pay attention to that.
Well, thank you. And of course, within the administration's overall budget priorities, we will be having those discussions.
And I left Representative Wilson out because we're both in the same boat in Southeast. No offense.
Representative Edgeman.
Through the chair, to sort of continue on the line of conversation that Representative Johansson was directing to Commissioner Lloyd, in terms of genetic stock identification and its role not only in managing our fisheries, but also maybe in developing new and underutilized fisheries, can you speak a little bit to your sort of vision as to where genetic stock IDing could be, you know, let's just say within the next 4 years during the tenure of the governor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edgeman, genetic stock identification is one of those tools that holds a tremendous degree of promise to answer a wide variety of questions. And my discussion will start with salmon, and if you want me to proceed to other species, I can do that later. But simply for salmon, we have so many questions in fisheries around the state of exactly what stocks are being harvested and to what extent within a particular harvest area, that the answers would be helpful biologically as well as in allocation discussions amongst various user groups about, you know, what fish are being taken where. And in the mid-90s, we had developed in the department a good, but in retrospect now, a rudimentary tool to deal with, well, to utilize allozymes as a detecting mechanism. And that allowed us to, for example, distinguish chum salmon from Western Alaska from those spawned in Southeast Alaska, from those spawned in South Central Alaska, Russia, Japan, major geographic areas. That helped address some questions, and in fact, for the high seas gill netting debate in the early 90s, it was very, very helpful in our discussions internationally to halt the practice of high seas gill netting of salmon. And more locally, it informed the debate on some of the interregional discussions on mixed stock fisheries versus fish that are passing through those fisheries and getting into more terminal areas and then in spawning grounds. However, with that broad scale geographic differentiation, it still didn't get to some of the questions that we as a department would ask. For example, are fish taken along the North Peninsula, North Alaska Peninsula, or in the Ugashik area, going to the Kwajak or to the Naknek or to the Egigik system, so that we could do a good run reconstruction and better understand the productivity dynamics of those systems. We now are developing tools that have that discriminatory ability. And you may hear the term, if you talk to Dr. Sieb and others, of SNPs, and that's single nucleotide polymorphisms. And this is a very fine level of discernment of proteins within the DNA strand and how they match up with their various double helix structure. And with that, we've been developing a statewide baseline for sockeye salmon, a pretty good baseline for Chinook salmon, and we're in the process of developing a very good baseline on chum salmon. It's, however, a fairly expensive endeavor, mostly for the chemicals that are required to conduct the analyses. And so while we're poised to utilize this tool, we still lack the funding to deploy it comprehensively around the coastline. I'm not sure that this is a sufficient answer, if you'd like to proceed further.
Representative Edmund.
Mr. Chairman, and the other component of my original or my question a moment ago was certainly the development of other stocks. And I guess in terms of asking you about your vision about the genetic stock, the capabilities of the department that exist today and that could potentially exist tomorrow. You know, from what I understand about the program, it could be a really wide-ranging tool, also not only for management or discernment of particular stocks, as you just mentioned, but also for maybe developing other fisheries and so forth outside of salmon. Would you agree with that?
I believe I understand where you might be headed, but I'm not entirely sure. So, for example, the development of other fisheries, we may be able to utilize genetic stock identification techniques to be able to track animals that are utilizing enhancement efforts to gauge the success of those enhancement efforts, so that if indeed we find that enhancement of, say, for example, red king crab can be done, and we can monitor those transplants in the wild through genetic analytical techniques, then that could indeed lead into the future to enhance fishery opportunity. Is that the type of thing you're referring to?
Representative Benjamin?
Just one last comment, and I guess what I'm specifically referring to is we had a wide-ranging discussion on gooey ducks in this committee as well as in the Resources Committee. And what I heard the department basically say is that there really wasn't a good enough understanding of being able to take this one species and put it in another area, in a non-native area, if you will. But what I read in the material that was presented to this committee was discussion about how British Columbia, was it Washington, the state of Oregon, had genetic stock ID efforts regarding that particular species. And I may be wrong, but I'm just quoting off what I recall reading. So that's where I'm sort of going with this very vague question I'm inviting you.
Mr. Chair, I don't know how genetic stock ID pertains to the transplant of an animal to a region to which it's not indigenous. So a bit of a lot. Even if we could use the technique to distinguish between British Columbia gooey ducks and Alaska gooey ducks, which we may or may not be able to do, I'm just not familiar. But even if we could do that, it doesn't directly address the question of whether we ought to be transplanting gooey ducks from Southeast Alaska to, say, for example, South Central Alaska, where they don't normally occur.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I get a little nervous when we start talking about discrete stock versus mixed stock management practices. Back in the 90s, there were a couple bills introduced, for whatever reason, that dealt with discrete stock management. And what made us nervous down in Southeast, I don't know geographically how things are up in other parts of the state, but as you know, we've got hundreds and hundreds of streams that have all kinds of different runs. And I don't know if I have a question, but just to let you know, it makes me a little nervous when we talk about that. You know, if we ID a stock to a certain stream and that stock has problems, the entire mixed stock out there could be affected. And at least that's what I remember the testimony being. And therefore, our commercial fleet may be restricted from harvesting because of one individual stream that's having problems. I don't know, you don't have to comment, but if you have something to say about that, I'd certainly like to hear about it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's a very important public policy question, and I guess I'll lay a framework for how I view these considerations, and that is all of our commercial salmon fisheries are mixed stock fisheries. We do not have any one that I know of that is a single stock fishery. And to proceed a little further, the Bristol Bay sockeye fishery is considered a terminal fishery, and perhaps of any of them in the state is the most terminal. However, within each one of those districts, which are basically in the mouths of rivers, they are harvesting fish that are going to other areas to spawn. So indeed, those are mixed stock fisheries as well. In any kind of discussion of discrete stock management or weak stock management, we need to keep in mind the maximum benefit tenet of the Constitution, and not simply say to protect one small stock necessarily requires the elimination of fishing on other stocks. I think we need to look for the opportunities to protect that stock biologically if necessary, but to also take advantage of other harvestable surpluses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I appreciate that as well, because weak stock management can basically be the death of Alaska's reputation as being one of the best managed fisheries in the world. I mean, we could probably achieve all the minimum escapement goals if we shut all the fishing, sport, commercial, and subsistence down. And the question is, what do we gain? I guess there was one other thing. We had a we had testimony from a past member of the administration, high-level fisheries person, who questioned about the mariculture being in the Department of Fish and Game. This is shellfish mariculture section, and not the dive fishery wild stock, but the and whether that is really a anything that the department has a priority, or whether it's almost a zero priority, and whether it would be better to move that to commerce or agriculture or someplace else that has kind of that same mission. And you know, what kind of disturbed us was the testimony from the mariculture specialist that said, I'm quoting here, unfortunately, we don't have a mandate for this, doing research for shellfish. Most of the monies are going for other commercial endeavors. We have to do it on an opportunistic basis. And mariculture has a lot of opportunity for this state. And I think you kind of addressed it, that you were going to be having some interdepartmental meetings. But I'd really like you to address whether is it going to be part of the mission, or a significant part of the mission, to work with mariculture, or should that be transferred to a department that has that mission to, like agriculture?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that either is an either-or question. To the extent that we have biological concerns with what happens with mariculture, I would maintain that we need to keep some authority within the Department of Fish and Game. If it's a question of promoting further opportunities shy of biological difficulties, I'm not sure I would mind having the Department of Commerce or some other department be the permitting agent, similar to how DNR right now is responsible for permitting at least the use of tidelands for some of these activities. It's not a zero priority within the department, and I would hope that's obvious, but it is the new kid on the block, and so is suffering growing pains, and that's something we have to deal with.
Okay. Well, we have missed all our miscellaneous saltwater fisheries and a lot of other important things like herring and all. We do have some people online, but we have at least from Bruce Wallace, we have testimony, written testimony. So we have two folks that will take very quick testimony from. Beaver Nelson, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Beaver. Would you go ahead and identify yourself? And if you have some information to give us that would help us in our assessment here, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, my name's Beaver Nelson. I've lived in Homer since 1968, been a commercial fisherman all those years, worked for the department earlier there for a couple of years, avid sports fisherman and hunter. And I'm fairly involved in the Board of Fish process. I've been around Denby at various times over the years, and I can report that his depth of experience is, I think, is very, very valuable at the commissioner level. He's extremely easy to work with, and the thing I like best about him is that he listens before he speaks. He's thoughtful, analytical, and he puts his brain in gear before he talks, and I think that's a very, very, really a good deal there. And anyone who's worked with him over the years knows that has extremely good relationships with all his other employees and all, and I just want to put in a good word for him, and I think he'd be a best candidate for commissioner I can think of.
Thank you, Beaver. Appreciate it. Any questions? Okay, thank you. We have one other person, John Jensen, online. John, we are being called to the floor, so if you could make it very short, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd concur with Mr. Nelson's comments, and I've known Mr. Lloyd for quite a few years, and both as a commercial fisherman and a member of the Board of Fisheries, and I highly recommend them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here that present that needs to feel an obligation that they need to speak? If not, great. I'll close the public testimony. Denby, I think we've appreciated your candid sharing of your views and philosophies and the experience that you've got, and we appreciate your participation with this. Representative Ledoux?
Yeah, I'm honored to make a motion to move my good friend Denby Lloyd out of committee. I think he's going to make a great commissioner.
And that is a recommendation, or we are...
Can I object?
We've got an objection. Representative Wilson?
I only object because I want to make a couple comments. Yeah. I just wanted to comment that I didn't get one single person that, you know, lots of times when something like this comes up, you have people from both sides saying, no, don't do this, or yes, do it. And I didn't get anything negative. And that your reputation does precede you, and you're noted for your fairness and your accountability. And I really appreciate that. And that means a lot to me. And also, he's left-handed, so he's got to be good.
So
I remove my objection. Okay.
And so the motion is that the Fisheries Committee forwards the nomination of Denby Lloyd for Commissioner of Fish and Game for consideration by the joint session of the legislature. And seeing no objections to that, we will move that, and appreciate your time and effort with us, and we hope to look forward to more conversations in the future and following up on some of these issues we've talked about today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
And we will be adjourned. It is 10 o'clock.